Talk given Saturday, 30th November, 1974. In the ordinary worldly life of the individual, as well as in the lives of societies, communities, and of nations, problems constantly arise. And the tendency is to look back into the past, into history, into our own past experience, and search the corridors of memory, recall situations which were similar situations as the one with which one is confronted now, and then try to apply that experience of the past and what one may have gathered from it to meet the present situation. This is what all human beings do and have done through the ages. In the worldly context, we call it the wisdom of the ages. In the context of the religious life, the same thing happens. All sorts of problems confront us, and we look back into the past and recall how we met them. And in addition to that, which all the rest of the world also does in the worldly manner, in addition to that, we add the influence of our moral codes, our ideals, our conceptions of the meaning of life and its purposes, and how we ought to live as human beings with a sense of something greater than us, a destiny to which we are towards which we are moving. Now this is what actually happens with us. And yet, the great spiritual teachers have also suggested, and in some cases very strongly emphasized, a total rejection of the past. Instead of looking into the past, they have pointed out the necessity of being wholly attentive to the immediate now, the immediate present, which is what actually faces us and confronts us. Now this is truth, but whilst the intellect may give its assent, yes, this is truth, I'm assuming that all of us here intellectually are giving assent. Whilst the intellect may give assent that this is truth, the question arises, have I the capacity to live in accord with that to which my intellect has given assent? Supposing I say, yes, that is so, I must be totally attentive to the now and I'll reject the past. But can I do it? Am I capable, in other words? Have I the capacity, the skill? Have I the strength, the power to fulfill that? And it would be extremely difficult to find a single case where one could say, yes, I have. You see, vision always outstrips capacity, faculty. Inspiration or sheer intellectual penetration or some sort of experience which is a revelation may show us a transcendental truth. But that vision was granted us, and it took place in the ripeness of a circumstance which is quite an extraordinary circumstance. The circumstance passes, the situation changes, we are plunged back again into the state in which the world is. Turmoil, confusion, conflict, ignorance, groping in the dark, and so forth. When I'm back in that condition, I find I cannot live up to the vision. So now one begins to wonder, are the great teachers right in speaking in these terms? From the outset, we must admit the fact that we as we are incapable of living up to that stage. One may look at it analogically a little bit, and this I know from my personal experience. Supposing you have a gift as a musician, as an executant, you start practicing. Let us say you are fortunate enough to go to a teacher who is absolutely at the top of the tree. And he will demonstrate to you on the instrument. No, not like that, but like this. Well, all right, I try to play it like this as the teacher wants me to, and I can't. The skill and the capacity to do is outstripped by the reality which one can perceive in the distance, the perfection which one can perceive in the distance. The temptation is then to discard the teaching of the teacher and go on in one's own gentle, sometimes not so gentle, muddling way, hoping that we'll muddle through somehow to that point. What is the reason why we react like this? Deep down within the psyche, there are so many forces at play of which we remain unconscious. First and foremost, there are those desires which drive us in our life. Our longings for pleasure, for security, success, love as we define it, and so on. And in every case, our conceptions of these are far from what they really stand for. We don't know what true pleasure is. We chase after sensational excitements. We don't know what true happiness is. Our minds are conditioned into all sorts of pictures by our society, by our immediate circle of family and friends, by all the novels and the magazines and the gloss and glamour of this stupid world. So we haven't even the shadow of the ghost of an idea of what true happiness is. Security? We seek security despite the fact that there is no meaning to the word security in a world in which everything is continuously changing and in which the unexpected and the unforeseen plays a much more powerful part than that which we see and know. And as for love, the less said about it, the better. If there is anything we as a human race have despoiled to the nth degree, it is that which is represented by this monosyllable love. But we can see, therefore, that all our misconceptions and all our conditioning is a very powerful psychical energy deep down in the unconscious, which is at play, whether we like it or not, whether we perceive it or not. It is at play. And it is continuously spoiling our conscious life. Therefore, we are in a state of confusion. We are always groping, trying to make our way through a fog. Now, that is the reason why we feel like going on in our old sweet way. Not so sweet sometimes. It's a bitter way. A sad way. Have we ever looked carefully, standing at a street, on the pavement or at a street corner, at the faces of those who go past? Have we noticed the way they walk, the way they talk? Does it show something which is true to life? Or something which represents this miserable sorrow and conflict which crushes the humanity in us? We have to watch these things and try and understand their real significance. We haven't that clarity of vision, that depth of understanding, which can deal with these deep forces in the subconscious, in the well of the unconscious. Now, these forces are at play in each of us as individuals, not through our fault or anything like that. That is an easy explanation to give. It's rather a facile explanation, but it isn't worth much. It is there inevitably because through the 2 or 3 million years that mankind has been on the globe, we have been subjected to conditioning by natural evolution and by our socio-cultural heritage. Natural evolution comes first. It has been the most powerful factor. This organism, which is named a human being belonging to the human species, is derived from an animal ancestor which obeyed the law of the jungle. Do not think immediately in terms of red in tooth and claw, but see the deeper significance of the law of the jungle. The animal organism functions entirely in terms of living unto itself. It draws the world unto itself, and it draws everything necessary for the continuity of itself. It's during its own lifetime, and in order that the species may be perpetuated for the sake of the species. So you see, food, protection, personal safety, and procreation play the most important part in the life of the animal. And there are all the various conditioned reflexes and so forth which we inherit as a result of our animal evolution. You know, we don't really appreciate the extent of all this, but we should look into it very, very deeply. So aggressiveness, fear, anxiety, grasping, always making the self the center of the whole universe, characterizes us as human beings. This is the most powerful factor. And because this factor has been at play through the millennia, through the tens of thousands of years, all our socio-cultural growth, as we call it, has been determined by those factors, centered towards the self, in order that I may be well, safe, enjoying my pleasures, having enough food, and all the rest of it. And in this process, there has come into being a veneer through the activity of the brain and the intellect and the aesthetic aspect of our nature, a veneer of the arts and civilization and so forth. The things which we are so proud of and boast of and say, look at our wonderful creations in the fine arts, in science, in philosophy, and so forth. In city-states, in kingdoms, in empires, and all the rest of it. when there is a global or even less than global upheaval in our history, as has happened at least twice in our own century, what happens to that veneer of gentlemanliness and ladylikeness? Have you ever watched the faces of the nice people, the good people, the people with fine impulses and noble aspirations, when they were listening to the news over the BBC during the last war? If you happened to watch their faces and understood what you were watching, you would have gone through terrible distress to see this veneer of gentleness, of courtesy, of fellow feeling, of brotherliness, all wiped out. And the beast in oneself, with all its devilishness, I won't say animal in oneself, because animals are decent creatures living according to the law of their being, but the beast in oneself burst out. And it is you and I, individual men and women, who have produced this Frankenstein inside ourselves, this monster, by virtue of the misfortune, let's put it kindly, by virtue of the misfortune of being unable, through the past, of ever understanding how natural evolution worked and the forces it let loose. Now, we must understand this very, very clearly. And understanding implies no condemnation. This is how it was. That's the fact. It's difficult to see the fact truly. I've already said something about our difficulty from within ourselves, from the unconscious part of ourselves, which prevents us from seeing and understanding. We twist what we see and imagine, I've seen the truth. I have, I haven't. We must try and understand this carefully, you see. Therefore, no condemnations. On the other hand, no approvals either. Now let us try and consider, what is it that has made the great teachers talk in terms of rejecting the past? There are apparently obvious arguments against such a rejection. For instance, it is a fact that what I am now is the product of all that preceded me. That is a fact. If you look, for instance, in the Dhammapada, I was just looking through all the different translations I've got. There are five of them here, by distinguished scholars, East and West. If you look at all those translations, the Dhammapada, Dhammapada simply means the way of the holy life, the Dhamma. The way of the holy life begins with the statement that all our tendencies of character, all our feelings, perceptions, mental formations are the result of our consciousness, of our mind. They are mind-made, they are mind-dominated, and so forth. If the mind is ill, is evil in intent, then suffering inevitably follows the person, just as the wheel of the cart follows the ox which drags it. And if the mind is well-intentioned, pure, then happiness comes to that person. This is how they put it. Now, what makes for the ill mind or the well-intentioned mind? Our aspirations, our activities and so forth. And therefore we say that right through one's past, from infancy onwards, the forces have played their part to produce me now. In other words, I have changed in accordance with those forces. But remember, our conception of these forces, our conceptions, I should say, are misconceptions very largely, and true perception only very, very slightly. That is one point to bear in mind in this connection. And another point is this, that all the influences of the past brought about changes, continual changes, which led up to the present. But those changes have two broad aspects. There is change which is mere modification, a mere rearrangement of what is actually there at the moment, like rearranging the same old furniture in a room, that's all. I'm not using the word modification in the sense in which your scientist, your biologist and so on uses it when he's talking of evolution, that the organism by adaptation to the circumstance and bending the circumstance to his will, the environment and so forth, brings about a modification. That is a different, slightly different meaning of the word, a more advanced, developed meaning of the word modification. I'm talking of modification merely in the sense of a rearrangement of that which is actually there. And if you look into our lives now, or look right back into history, you'll find that perhaps the greater part of change which goes on is just this kind of rearrangement of old junk. There is another aspect of change. Where there is a mere rearrangement, there is no real growth. Where mere rearrangement is concerned, there is usually a steady regression towards decay, disruption, and death. The old stuff is finished with. Just as I wear out my handkerchiefs right to the bitter end so that there is no more handkerchief left. That sort of thing. But this other kind of change is something which is related to life. What characterizes life supremely? Action which is creative. When we talk of life and the life process, it is a creative process. Creation is something which we do not know. What is creation? I don't know. Do you? It's a mystery. Mere modification, mere rearrangement, taking hold of old things and putting them together in a different way and so forth, is not creation. But this mystery of creation is perpetually at play where the activity of life is concerned. Now, we are all living creatures. Psychophysically, bodily, mentally, hyphenate the words. We are living creatures, and in us some changes come about which are the result of creative action, of creative energy at play. When creative energy is at play, then there is real growth. Something quite different from a mere putting together, a building up, to use a Hindu Buddhist term, sankhara. Sankhata, that which is just put together. That is not it. That is mechanical synthesizing. Whereas the way of life, the way of creation, is an integrative process. It integrates. And one of its outstanding characteristics is the fact that true integration produces something totally new. The unknown has come into being. And after it has come into being, provided we are sensitive and can use our senses, sight, hearing, etc., after it has come into being, we perceive it and recognize it as, this is new. As far as the new is concerned, there is no falling back. You are with it in the immediate now. Another point to bear in mind is this. Where mere rearrangement is concerned, we are caught within the sphere of time. And within time, there is a beginning, a proceeding, a decaying, and a dying. There is conflict, there is confusion, there are mistakes, there is sorrow, there is destruction, there is death. In the context of time. But creation is timeless. When does it happen? Where does it happen? How does it happen? All unanswerable questions. Creation and creative activity are of the nature of the immeasurable. Therefore, unseizable. You can't grasp it. God is called Creator in the orthodox theologies of the world. God as Creator, transcendent, is the unseizable, ungraspable, the unknowable, in our sense of the word, no. We can only use words like this which give us an intellectual and an emotional sensation. An intellectual sensation, remember. So you see, creation belongs to the timeless. The context of the timeless, the context of the immeasurable. I, the separate entity, cannot touch it, cannot do anything to it. It can do everything to me. Whereas that which is a mere rearrangement, I can deal with. I can control those energies, those objects, which are within the context of time. Now, if we have understood this, we will understand something of tremendous importance. It is really the crux of the matter, of the difficulty. And if you understand this, your difficulty will really disappear. When we look back into the past, what are we looking at? The past? No, it's gone, it's dead. The living reality, the actuality, is here now, this very second. There is no other actuality. That past has gone. So when we say we are looking back into the past, we are looking back into our memories. We are looking back into the memories of other people which have come down as history, as stories, as accounts, as statements, and so forth. We are looking at certain words which they use to express something in their minds, and my conditioned mind is trying to interpret, and generally misinterprets, the faulty statement of those conditioned minds. So we are in a wonderful mess. This is what we are looking at. We are looking at our own memories. And what is there in the memory? What constitutes the memory? It's a thought shape. It's a thought form. A thought form structured by our faculty of speech as so many different words. Now, when the event occurred, which, say, 50 years ago, which I remember now, did my mind, in the first instance, even make a true thought shape of that which was happening? Did it? Or was it a distorted, false shape? Of course it was a distorted, false shape. If you and I are capable of making true thought shapes, thought forms, of whatsoever comes within our ken, supposing we are all together witnessing some incident, you see, how is it that every one of us gives a different description of it? If we truly perceived, then we ought to be able to give the same description. But we don't. Why doesn't the evidence tally? You see, because this psychophysical organism, which is me, myself, is an incomplete, an imperfect one, an incapable one, an ill one. And therefore the thought shape made is a false shape. And I store that in my memory, as I call it. Even there, in this storing, there is a great defect. Through the years, that stored memory is never the same memory, never the same shape. It's always undergoing changes ever so slightly. By the play of my own desires, my passions, my successes, my failures, my new conceptions and ideas and all the rest of it. See, the element of the continuity of fact or truth is so slight compared with the vastness of the element of confusion, of misrepresentation. So, what value is there in that memory of the past? Look, go deeply into this in the quiet moments that you can find. Don't go into it actively, in a great stir and like a bomb going off somewhere. Go into it quietly. Let your mind dwell upon it peacefully, undesirously. That is the most fundamentally important point. And in that quietness will come great illumination as regards the nature of the whole of one's own past and the whole of the past of mankind and of the world. Then you will find that at the same time there will emerge the power to be free of the limitations imposed upon oneself by the memories of the past. The memories will stay. You can't eradicate them because the whole of the past, every single second, whatsoever is going on around and within myself, is impressed on my brain cells and all the cells of my body. This is the meaning, one of the tremendous meanings of having a live body. It is the repository of the totality of the life process. Don't you see? And therefore it contains everything in here, in the organism itself. Cleanse the organism, the psyche and the body, both. And then there is the possibility of paying full attention to the immediate now. The cleansing of the psyche is the more important aspect as compared with the cleansing of the body. And the two together in their harmony constitute one of the deep meanings of yoga. Now, does this mean, therefore, that the whole of the past is a waste and useless? Not at all. As I said earlier, there have been those creative moments, the moments of transformation within yourself, of not only transformation, a changing of quality, of the refinement and the sensitivity of substance, of psyche and so forth, but an actual transmutation. Those of you who know modern physics and so forth will appreciate the real meaning of this word transmutation. It is the magic of creation, this transmutation. And when this transmutation takes place in those marvelous moments of insight, of the true metanoia, the conversion in the real sense, what happens is that the experiencing of the moment is not a total waste, but it has made for the growth of faculty within the mind. What faculty? It has made for the release, the awakening, the release, and the right functioning of intelligence. Intelligence meaning the power to see the truth of things as they are in the immediate present, the immediate now. Supposing you and I can do this right now. Awaken and use this faculty of intelligence. You see what happens? The functioning of this intelligence does away with all the limitations that that heap of rubbish in the subconscious, in the unconscious, would impose upon us. All our memories of the past, all our absurd thought shapes of the past and so forth. All that would go. And with it would go all the resentments and the miseries and the hatreds and angers because of these memories. That person did that to me, he or she did wrong, and all the rest of it. All that poison in the soul is just transmuted. Who transmutes it? You yourself. The you yourself whom you do not know. God within oneself, the transcendence which is embodied here, is not known by this, the brain, never will be. So you see, this way there is liberation. There is freedom. And the wonderful thing about it is this. One may feel hopeless and say, oh, this is so beyond me. Yes, it is so beyond me. And yet, where is the beyond? I'll tell you. It's right inside yourself. That's where the beyond is. Nowhere else. That beyond is right within your own being. And if once the thing happens and you are awake to it, then for all your lifetime, barring some horrible accident which may just deprive you of all mental faculty, for all your lifetime, you can let that operate. Message of hope? No, don't use the word hope in this context. Because if you think of it as a message of hope, with hope you cannot avoid associating expectations. And the expectations are my thought shapes, remember. Out with the whole lot of imposters. The truth, the reality is so marvelous, so wonderful. It won't compel you. It just waits at the door. It won't even knock at the door. This is our individual task in the world. Let the doors, windows, and the walls vanish. And the truth of things in the eternal now is open to your whole attention.